That's my secret sauce to scaling, because not only did I get my money back to be able to buy the next apartment, but if you have a company or if you get really good at repositioning that asset and it increases in value, you can take that $20,000 out on top of it while still keeping the investment, which really helps velocitize your money.
Welcome to the Passive Income Brothers podcast.
Here, we take the fear out of real estate investing using real life stories of everyday successful investors.
Let's go.
Welcome to another episode of the Passive Income Brothers podcast. My name is Tim Lyons, and today I'm joined by my brother and co-host, Greg Lyons. How are you today, Greg?
Tim, I am doing great. And we just finished up a great podcast with Logan Rankin, and so many value bombs he was dropping for us. Just the way books changed his life. You know, he comes from a middle-class background, working hard, books really changing his life. And he's a smart dude, and he's really leveraged what he was doing early on in his career in the retail world and has brought that to his real estate business. So really, really interesting listen, and just a really, really solid real estate entrepreneur.
I'm fired up. I mean, this guy is young. He was financially free and a multimillionaire by the time he was 30. So let that sink in. This is not fake news. This is not guru type stuff. He owns and operates all of his own units. And I think if you hang on deep enough into the podcast, you're going to find out just how many units that is. And he also has a very special offer for you listeners for his brand new book that launches this week. So hang on to the show, wait for that offer, and be sure to check out our show notes. But without further ado, let's jump into the episode. Welcome to the show, Logan Rankin. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you guys?
Doing fabulous. So I am so excited to dive into today's show because we had an opportunity to meet Logan last October at Jake and Gino's Multifamily Mastery 4. And to say that I was blown away by his story is an understatement. And in fact, when we were at the VIP dinner, I'm pretty sure I was texting Greg the entire time, like, dude, this guy Logan is unbelievable. He's got it going on. So, Greg, do you remember those?
Oh, absolutely. The text messages were flying. And I think more than anything, it was just, I think you were blown away by the mindset and the, you know, it's just the inspiration of being around someone that's doing it. And that was just, I do remember that time. It was last year. And we've been watching Logan kind of grow and do his thing ever since then. And we are just so excited to have him on the podcast today.
No doubt. So Logan, I don't know if you remember that VIP dinner that we were at that night. Luke Wren had everybody fired up. And I was sitting next to Colin Schwartz, who was another Jake and Gino guy. He was on our podcast a couple of weeks ago. And dude, we were literally about to start doing push-ups like in the main ballroom because Luke Wren had us fired up. But anyway, could you take the listeners back a little bit? Because you're a young guy. You have kind of done a lot in a little bit of time. So can you take the listeners back a little bit? How you're journey kind of began?
Yeah, that sounds good. Thanks again, guys. That was a fun event for sure. Yeah, so for me, grew up in northeastern Wisconsin, small town, blue class kind of town, hardworking for sure, but just not a lot of financial literacy, not from school, society, my family, hardworking again, but we didn't talk about money. We didn't know anything about money. And anyway, speed up, you go through high school, you go through college, still don't learn anything about financial literacy. But I knew I wanted money, you know, not having money, you know, you want to do something different. And I did what most people do or what you were taught. I got a job for a corporation. I started working for a Fortune 50 company, as you shared, and in retail leadership. And I did that for 2-3 years before I just, and by the way, during those 2-3 years, I'm doing everything I was taught. I'm paying off all my student loans because all debt's bad debt, right? I'm saving money. And then, you know, if you're investing, you should just throw it into a 401k. So that's what I was doing. And I just, after doing that for 2-3 years, I got promoted a couple times. I'm liking the whole leadership gig. I played college basketball. I've always loved leadership. So the job, it fit me great. I got an opportunity to take on responsibility and lead, and it paid pretty well. And it took nights and weekends and 70 to 80 hours a week. And I wasn't afraid of hard work, right? That's how I was raised. But I could not feel my money working hard. So I started, someone said, you just got to start reading books. So you start reading some personal finance books and some real estate books. And eventually, you know, if you read enough wealth building books, you fall into real estate. I tried everything. That's for maybe a different podcast. I made a ton of mistakes. I've literally tried stocks, you know, IRAs, all the traditional type investments. It just didn't work. finally, I'm like, we're just going to do it. This real estate thing is the only thing we haven't tried. I know everybody's saying it's risky, but I just read these last three books, right? I didn't talk to anybody. It just all came from books. And I told my wife, Ashley, at the time, I said, I think we can buy this single family house. It's across from a golf course. It's a great deal. And I underwrote the deal based on what this book just said. It should cash flow $3,300. And if it does, after a year, we'll go on a vacation with that money. So we bought that. And I remember to this day, we had like $7.26 left in our bank account afterwards. So super risky, a little scary. But a year went by and we're within $50 of that $3,300. And it changed everything for me, guys. So not the money, obviously, but the fact that I could accurately predict how much money I was going to make, and it was in my bank account. Because if you asked me to accurately predict how much I'd make in my 401k a year from today, I'd have no idea. And better yet, this was actually in my bank account. So then instead of taking my wife on that vacation, I convinced her to buy a duplex that next year. So we doubled down, we bought two units, and we went broke again. And then the next year after that, we bought four units. So we doubled again, and we went broke again. And that's kind of our theme, guys. So you know, for the first, I'd say 5 years, we started it really, really slow. We retained all the equity and I learned a lot. My first seven units, I managed them all myself. If anybody that knows anything about me knows, I don't know how to fix a toilet, but I did know how to find someone that could fix a toilet. And then around 7 to 10 units, I hired a third party property management company, continued to go broke investing in real estate. And things started to speed up around, you know, I think year five. I'm now a vice president and leading a lot of people. And I'm starting to realize like the things that are making me great at my W-2 job, leading people. But more than that, I loved operations. Like I love looking at inefficiencies on how businesses or stores were run. And I could obsess over a P&L, just love numbers. Once I realized that those skills could be easily translated into real estate, and I stopped looking at my real estate as a property, and I started looking at my real estate buildings as businesses, it really started to explode. I'm in Wisconsin. It's hard to really count on appreciation. But once I learned you can force appreciation through driving your business's NOI, I started to grow a lot more. And in the beginning of 2019, I had about 180, 200 units. Enough when I calculated it that I could retire from my job, because it's not what you make, it's what you keep. So I was still making more in my W-2 job at this time at a pretty high level position. But if you look at what I was keeping and the fact that I was working like maybe 10 hours a week on those 180, 200 units, it made sense to be able to leave. So I left. First thing I did, because I love operations and I like control over my investments, I started a property management company, started it. It's a long story, but I actually started with somebody. He's amazing. That's really good with people, really good with culture like myself. But this guy actually knew nothing about real estate, didn't even own something in real estate. But that's who I picked to run my company. And we had four employees at the time. Today, this morning, we just hired our 74th employee. And we took the business from, you know, the first year, $96,000 in payroll, to this year, we'll probably pay out over $3 million in payroll. Close around $20 million worth of revenue at that property management business. So it's really, really exploded. I'm super proud of that. And it's helped me also be able to acquire more and more value add apartments. So today, last week, Thursday, I closed on an 82 unit, bringing my total count to 1,923 units. So I've closed I closed 587 units so far this year. And still to Tim's point, I do retain all the equity. So,
Logan. Everyone take a breather.
Jesus,
everyone take
Mary
a breather.
And Joseph, like, exactly. Holy Christmas.
There's so many great points here to really go over, but at the end of the day, real estate is a get rich slow scheme. And you just took us through your journey in about 2.5 minutes right there, but it took you nearly 10 years to get to that point. And that's the point a lot of people miss when they're getting invested in real estate. How fast can I double my money? How fast can I get more units? It's really get rich slow. It's the habits that you have that build your portfolio. But it seems like when you had your W-2 job, you were doing everything right. And you dove into the real estate game. And you know, action is the biggest thing people don't take. You took action. And you, by learning, you came back, you kept coming back to real estate. And after that first unit, you had that proof of concept. And I think a lot of people really miss that point when they're getting either their spouse on board, getting themselves on board with real estate. You got to jump in. You have to have that proof of concept. And you did that in an unbelievable way. And when you're building and you're just figuring things out, I think mindset is such a huge part of the way we grow. And I know you're big into mindset and self-education and all those things. Take us through, after that first unit, how did your mindset shift to becoming a real estate entrepreneur?
Yeah, I honestly, the biggest shift for me is because up until that point in my entire life, other than reading some books, like I was taught that investing is gambling. Like I was taught that you should, just because people tell you to put your money in these traditional retirement accounts that, by the way, I think are extinct and long gone and really, really tough to be able to retire on today. I think they always were, but especially today with inflation. But like, you know, I remember putting my money in my 401k. I remember someone telling me it's free. And then I also remember reading 2 years later, after I've been investing for 2 years, that I can't touch that money until it's 59 and a half without significant penalty. And I literally remember reading this in the book, Craig, and being like, I got to Google this because this can't be right. That's you're saying they're going to penalize me for wanting my money back. Like that in general should throw up so many different red flags. So my mind shift was just the lack of overall understanding of where I was putting my money. And then the ability that another big concept change for me is that compound interest was pounded in my head through. And compound interest is great, but it doesn't touch velocity of money. And that first property that I bought, being able to have that money in my bank account, because I would never have been able to buy the duplex. We still do off somewhere between 10 to 15% of our gross income. That's our expenses. I put this in my book that we'll talk about later, but like, it's very important to know like how much you are spending, just to be aware of it. You're never going to cut your way to financial freedom, but it's very important to be able to understand the cash flow that you have to be able to reinvest. So after I bought that first investment, I knew how much money would I have to save, how long it would take to be able to buy the two units the next year. And I needed that $3,300 to be able to close on the duplex the next year. So I know I was kind of like joking about that, but my wife could see it too. And I think I like that you mentioned that, Greg, because I do think if you have a spouse, it's so important to bring them along on that journey and help them understand as well too, because it's their money too. And my wife was working just as hard as a nurse, and that proof of concept, knowing how much money I had, allowed me to be able to buy that duplex the next year.
Hey, Logan, you just touched on a great concept, and that is the velocity of money. And when people talk about investing, they always hear about compound interest. But can you just touch on 30 seconds, the velocity of money and what that's meant to your business?
Yeah, it's velocity of money. And specifically, I like looking at the metric cash on cash return versus ROI, right? So if you look at cash on cash return as a concept that you should pay the most attention to, it speaks to velocity of money, which is just, by the way, it's just how much money you put into an investment and then how fast you get it back. And I think that's really important, because I think it's Kevin O'Leary on Shark Tank always talks about, he sends his soldiers out, and they got to bring other soldiers back. And he wants to know how fast those soldiers are coming back to him. And that's what velocity is about. So for example, if you bought a $100,000 place, right, property, and it costed you $20,000 to be able to acquire that $100,000 property, you want to know what percentage is coming back to you every single year and how fast. Because in theory, then, if you're getting your money back at 25% cash on cash, in 4 years, you got your entire $20,000 back, which means then in 4 years, that property can continue the cash flow. And now you can take the $20,000 and be able to buy another property, right? Now you got two different properties. What I like about that versus compound interest, let's take the same concept in a 401k. If you put $20,000 to be able to buy into a 401k, you look at it and you can see an ROI, right? Your return on investment is, let's just say, 15%, or if it's this year, probably negative 10%. And you look at that and it's not in your bank account. You actually can't velocitize that money until you're 59 and a half, meaning that they keep it, right? They keep it and it's compounding, but you're not able to bring it back. And in times like today, it's not just about the velocity that matters. It's about, you know, being able to play the market and what's going on. Because for example, I think there's a lot of people that would like their money back at the beginning of this year and, you know, wouldn't like to have it compounded against inflation and something like a 401k. So velocity of money allows you to be able to do that. It's creating, and by the way, that's how I've been able to scale. That's my secret sauce to scaling, because not only did I get my money back to be able to buy the next apartment, but if you have a company or if you get really good at repositioning that asset and it increases in value, you can take that $20,000 out on top of it while still keeping the investment, which really helps velocitize your money.
Yeah, 100%. And I was going to focus that on that same point, Greg. So great point. And I want to stack on top. Like, you know, people always ask me sometimes, Tim, like, why do you like real estate so much more than, say, the 401k or, you know, maybe a Vanguard fund or Fidelity fund? And I kind of just use the analogy of, you know, if you had $100,000 in your capital account at Fidelity, and on Monday it went down by 10%, you'd have 90K left, right, in your capital account. And on Tuesday, if it went back up by 10%, you'd only have 99,000, right? So compound interest is a thing, and I believe in it. Yes, I do. But when you talk about velocitizing your money and having access to your capital to make the choices you want to make versus blindly putting it into a fund because this company's been doing it for 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 years, it's two totally different mindset shifts. And I really wanted to bring it back. You know, you said you would read a lot of books, and that's kind of how Greg and I got started. And I heard you on other podcasts saying, look, if I can read 10 pages a day, you know, every day, it's 300 pages a month. And that's maybe 10 or 12, you know, personal finance books a year. That's 10 pages a day, people, right? I mean, how hard is that going to be? You know, wake up a half hour earlier and you're going to be leaps and bounds ahead of other people. And so much of this is surrounded by our parents trying to do the right thing for us and teach us that conventional mindset about money, about saving and going to school and no debt and 401k. And I think Greg and I can really resonate, and probably a lot of our listeners, with your upbringing, right? Not a ton of money, didn't really talk about it. If we did talk about it, probably something was wrong. So when there's a lack of understanding about how money works and how your money's working for you and what to do and who to trust, we're kind of by proxy, we are taught that investing is gambling. So right there, there's like a mindset block, like investing equals fear, danger, your mind shuts down. You don't want to really go deep on anything because, you know, you just don't want to lose your money, especially if you don't have a lot of it. So my question to you is, you know, why is real estate the last thing on people's lists, right? They'll try day trading before they try real estate and they'll lose their shirt, guaranteed. They'll try options and they'll lose their shirt, guaranteed. They'll try swing trading, they'll try Bitcoin or other cryptos and they'll lose their shirt, probably guaranteed, right? And then all of a sudden, like they're positioning themselves back like from where they should have started. And real estate comes to the forefront. Like, why is it the last asset class that gets chosen to be acted upon?
Yeah, one of the reasons that I decided to write a financial literacy book too is because of not only this question, but like how society manipulates things at, you know, if you don't ask the right questions. Because you just said, before I answer this question, you just talked about a lot of like the same upbringing, you know, blue class, hardworking, your families. I mean, think about this for a second. Like somewhere along the line, like we've told, I mean, you know, my dad worked in the factory most of his life. He coached afterwards. My mom was a teacher, like hardworking. I know so many people that work hard for their money. But then we're taught like you're probably too tired to educate yourself, to make your money work hard for you, right? So because you already do so much, you should just give it to a financial advisor or just trust what society's telling you. Like that just pisses me off because the people that we know, right, Tim and Greg, they're not too tired, right? They don't know when to stop. Work ethic is ingrained into them. It's ingrained into us. So like the concept that you guys are probably too tired and we just accept that and then we give it to a financial advisor or we do these other things, honestly, just it really, really upsets me. But to answer your question, I think it's the same concept when it comes to why we pick real estate as last. It's because there's a misconception that real estate is risky, that it's riskier to be able to do that, right? It's the same thing of why they say when you put a money into a 401k and there's a 5% match that it's free. It's not free if you can't access it until a certain age. That's called jail. It's the opposite of free. So I, like to me, it's the same concept when you look at real estate as being risky. It's like, man, you know, it's really, really risky. You know, it costs a lot of money, like all these misconceptions. Because if you know what you're doing, it doesn't necessarily cost a lot of money. And if it did cost a lot of money, I remember helping coaching somebody that wanted to buy his first place and it was $15,000 as a down payment, right? This guy's making six digits. He's maxing out his 401k. And he said the exact same thing, Tim. He's like, yeah, I just don't know. $15,000, that's so risky. I said, you max out your 401k for $21,500, but because you did it every 2 weeks and you didn't see it and it's just gone and you're ignorant to it, that's not risky. I said, where is your $21,500 in your 401k? Can you at least tell me one fund? Couldn't do it. Could you tell me the fees on it? Couldn't do it. Do you have any idea how much it's going to return? Couldn't do it. So like, that's not risky, because that's what has been imprinted in our minds, is my point, right? That he didn't even think about it. He's invested more in a year than he was going to invest in one real estate property. Meanwhile, this guy didn't know a lot about real estate, but he knew how to underwrite a deal. He knew how to get insurance, and he had financing. The bank underwrote it too, right? I think that's another thing that people, the misconception about real estate, like you're, if like I underwrote my first deal reading books, but the bank still has to underwrite it. They're not going to give you money for the most part if it's a crappy deal. So you also have the Bain's experience underwriting it as well too. But the idea that real estate is risky, I think, is a misconception that has been imprinted in our minds. And if we ask the right questions, we really break it down. How much do I know about this real estate investment? And how much do I know about where I'm investing my current money? I hope, and I think people would have the same conclusion that I had, that whatever I was doing with my money was significantly more risky than the real estate investment, which is what led my wife and I to be able to buy that first place with $7 left in our bank account. Because I honestly felt that first property, I'm like, something is wrong here. Like, I feel like I'm missing something. Like, I can't wait for a year to go by. And if I'm missing something, at least then I know it was risky, like I thought. But then to be $50 within the $3,300, I'm like, what? And I kept educating. So I do think it's an education gap, but I also think it's a misconception of what is imprinted in our mind throughout school and in society. And obviously, I think there's reasons for that, right? That maybe we don't need to get into, but a lot of it has to do with Wall Street. A lot of it has to do with the fees that are made when we get to hold other people's money and be able to reinvest it. I think there's so many things that I've read into. Even the ideal American dream of owning your house benefits banks a lot. And there's a lot of people that benefit from these traditional ways that they want you to be able to invest your money versus doing it yourself and taking control of your investment and your money and your time.
All right. With Logan being a basketball player, I'm going to ask for a 30-second timeout right now. 30-second timeout. And now I know, Tim, this is why he wrote a book. Man's fired up about it. And he just wants to get the word out about his experience of doing two things. He's doing went the corporate route, went the entrepreneurial route. And I love to see, you know, how fired up he gets about this. So we're giving him a 30-second timeout, regain the composure, but he's so right. A lot of times, Tim and I always say real estate has a marketing problem. And, you know, Wall Street does a wonderful job of marketing, telling us where to put our money. And we're just conditioned to do that. But real estate, and I think podcasts like this and others, we try to get the word out that say, yeah, this is a viable option. And you don't have to go in 100%, but make it part of your portfolio. So when there is a market downturn and these sort of things, you are diversified, and others like yourself going all in. We're going all in on real estate just because we believe in the power of real estate. And the power of real estate is on display on this podcast with you having over 1,900 units. And I don't think people realize how hard it is to get to that kind of number, especially when you're doing it with your own money. I mean, it's obviously with banks' money and stuff like that. With over 1,900 units, a property management company, what's next for you and your company? Are you still in growth mode? And, you know, what's next for your company?
Yeah, my biggest goal now, when I crossed 1,000 units, I have more than enough money to do what my family and I want to do with. So my goals and my vision changed. You know, there's a few different things that I want to do now. I'm going to continue to accumulate units, first of all, because I just don't know where else to put my money that's safer, you know, with hedging inflation and everything else that's going on. Now it's just a velocity thing, right? The faster I invest my money, the faster I get it back. You know, if I get too much of it back, it just sits and gets gobbled up by inflation. So I have to put it back. So I'm going to continue to, you know, that's why I've closed on almost 600 this year. And I think I'll probably finish around 1250 this year. Actually, it's been a very strong year, all off market deals, but there's a bigger goal now. I want to disrupt property management across the United States, Greg. So that's probably one of my biggest goals right now. I think property management is kind of just like financial literacy in school. It's awful. So it's so old school. The people that continue to do property management, for the most part, there's obviously good property management companies out there, but we're not changing fast enough in this industry, guys. And housing is a huge problem. I mean, I still look at property management companies that are catering to baby boomers when Gen Z, Gen X, millennials are the number one renter and will continue to be the number one renter in the nation. And they have different expectations. You know, I laughed when I got into property management because people are like, oh yeah, like there's some stiff competition. No, there's not. I came from retail, like experience against Amazon and stuff like that. Like that's high. Property management is, it's awful. So we're doing a lot of really cool things that are geared towards the, what the renter wants. And they're all based on the experience that they get. For example, I can just share a few. Last year, at least in the state of Wisconsin, it took on average 49 days to be able to complete a service request when a resident needed something. So when a resident puts in, I need the garbage disposal fixed, on average, to get the garbage disposal fixed takes about 49 days. And we were about average across the United States. I mean, there's still a lot of those excuses with COVID, et cetera, labor. That, you want to fire me up, we talk about labor later, because I think it's a good problem, not contrary to what people believe. But for our company, we got those work orders completed in 48 hours, you know, 97% of the time. Like we're even close. Like if a resident moves in and they're paying good rent, like just ask a resident what they expect. If God forbid something goes wrong, they want it fixed and they want it fixed fast and they don't even want to see you. Like, so, or heaven forbid you call a property management company. For anybody listening today, I would encourage you call. If you have a third party management company, call them once and see if they pick up the phone. Most property management companies won't even pick up the phone, let alone return your call. So our goal is always to pick up the phone in the second ring, right? Our goal is to have the grass edge. Our goal when you walk in our common areas is that it actually smells good. Not just look good, you gotta smell good. I mean, these apartments, man, sometimes you walk in and, but anyway, we have 17 different standard operating procedures that we've been working really hard at over the last 24 months, I would say, last 2 years, to really, really separate ourselves from the competition. And we haven't even scratched the surface, but people are starting to notice. And I think that reputation is really, really big. It keeps people in. We can ask for higher rent. But it keeps retention high. I think everybody thinks like, you know, you make money on the lease up, but really you make money on the renewal. If you can really, really create an experience where people don't want to leave and people are proud of where they live. And, you know, like I said, we reposition too. So we rehab the units in 85% of our units we rehab, we do in-house too. But like, I also think they care a lot about how their apartment looks more than different generations. So that's one of my biggest goals, Greg. That was kind of a long one, but I really want to disrupt property management across the United States. So this year, our goal is to continue to expand. Right now, most of my 1,900 units are within a 50-mile radius. I have an apartment community about 200 miles away in Wisconsin. I'm looking at another one about 200. So we can just build up our systems. I'm a systems operations guy. That's what you need in property management. But I'd really like to do something with housing. And then along with my employees, one thing my wife and I are really passionate about is how do we build a foundation to help people with financial literacy, which is kind of what we're talking about a little bit here and get it into kids. I help with all my employees. My property management company, by the way, doesn't manage for anybody else, just myself and my employees. And all my employees get the benefit of the management fees at the same cost basis that I do, which is really, really low. So they can build wealth too. So I'm really focused on that. How do I help other people reach financial freedom faster than maybe they were told before?
Well, again, I love that, man. I mean, property management, you know, that's like the unsexy underbelly of real estate, right? Because if you're on social media or anything, you see all your friends, if they buy an apartment complex or a duplex, whatever they might be, they always highlight the acquisition and then the disposition. And the long time in between when you're running the property and providing that service to the customers, your renters, right? And how you treat them and create that experience. And people will pay a premium for a 48-hour turnaround on a leaky faucet or a garbage disposal or whatever, right? Because I think in the media, you could see, oh, wow, rents are out of control. They're grown by 20%. But like, if you're proud of where you live and has amenities and you're a millennial and you want to live in LA this year and Austin, Texas next year, and then, you know, wherever the following year, you're going to pay a premium to live in a certain spot. And that's kind of where, you know, Wayne Gretzky said, you got to skate to where the puck is going, right? And that's where you're going. Like, you're making sure those amenities and that service is foremost in the operation of your business. So I love that. You know, with that being said, could you just touch upon, you know, for the listeners, you know, why commercial real estate, right? 1-4 unit residential. That's how you got started. That's how a lot of people get started. I think almost every person that you and I know in this space probably got started either with like wholesale fix and flips or just buying single family rentals, duplexes, condos. And then all of a sudden, the light bulb gets turned on. They say, wait a minute, if I can have 7 units between, you know, the 1-4 unit space, I can certainly do 1900 units, right? And it's all about the operations like we just talked about. So why is it financially like the next step? Why do people do commercial versus that residential?
Yeah, I love this question. It's 3 reasons. It's always been the same 3 reasons. It's risk, it's my time, and it's business versus a property. So it is, from a time standpoint, as you start to learn this game, it takes almost as much time to be able to go through the due diligence and close on a 2 unit as it does 100 unit. I mean, it's relative. It does take a little bit more time at 100 unit and there's a little bit more moving parts, but the amount of time is not substantially different. So there's a huge return on your time going bigger. Risk, I mean, that one's so, I'm risk adverse. It's why I invest in C class and B class. I think it's a lot less risky. And then also I relate a lot to hardworking individuals and I want to really provide housing to that segment. But it's also a little bit riskier because they are hardworking individuals. They have jobs, they want to work, they don't want handouts. But bigger is if you have 1 vacancy on a duplex, it's a 50% vacancy rate. You can't even pay the mortgage. If you have, you know, 10 vacancies on 100 units, that's only a 10% vacancy rate too. Still would be bad, but it's not a 50%. So the bigger you get, I think a lot of people don't realize this, it's actually less risky. I actually think it's easier to finance too. Significantly easier to finance the bigger it is. It has a lot less to do with you as an individual and has a lot more to do with the property itself. And then from a business versus a property, I kind of shared this at the beginning, like 1-4 units, it's valued at comp sales, comparable sales. How hot is the market? Again, I'm in Northeastern Wisconsin. Plus, I don't like risk. So even if I was on the West Coast or the East Coast, like I don't love huge fluctuations in appreciation and I certainly don't invest on it. I'm a cash flow investor. So, you know, when you look at a bigger property, 5+ units, now you can value it on the NOI, the profit that property is producing. And that's actually what I'm really good at too. So it just happened to look like I love, my favorite thing's actually not real estate, guys, it's business. I love business. I love business. I love business. I love business. Everything about building wealth should be predicated on business and leadership, in my opinion. And when you look at a property like a business and you look at all the different ways you can make money on that property, there's so many. It's not just rent, right? I laugh when people are like, they're just focused so much on rent. You should be making 10 to 15% on other things that aren't rent. There's all these other ancillary expenses. And the best part about this business is like, don't get me wrong, every apartment community is a little bit different, but especially when you talk about apartment communities versus 1-4 units, they have the same levers that you could pull, right? So for example, if you understand how to expense optimize utilities, it's pretty much the same. So if you create a really good system for one apartment, one business, you can create it for all. And then you ideally could implement it more efficiently and more effectively time in and time out again. So you can still like figure out different ways to drive NOI, but then you really should be able to come up with 6 proven ways that just work over and over and over. So now when you're underwriting deals, instead of looking at a 1-4 unit and what it's going to appraise for and what does that look like, you can look at a 5-300 unit and see, have they pulled all the levers that you know you can pull? Mm-hmm. And what will that do for your NOI? Or more importantly, what would you do for the overall value of that property too? So you don't have to jump into it right away. Like I didn't either, Tim, like you're indicating, but I do think as soon as you can jump into it, you should, especially if you understand like how to focusing on pulling those different levers to increase NOI.
I love this podcast because we really, really see your business and business background and your retail experience come out, and you're bringing that to the real estate investing world. And that's such a like a cool thing to see when you take the skills that you had prior and putting it into your business now. I can't wait to read your book, and we'll get to your book in a second, but I can't wait to read it just because I think there's going to be so many valuable lessons in there for our listeners. But right now, let's be mindful of your time, and we're going to go to our three short answer questions, and you're just going to fire off whatever comes to mind with the thoughts that we give you. And the first one is, what do you say to people when they give back to you, investing in real estate is too risky? What do you say to those sort of people?
I say, you didn't educate yourself. How many books have you read? Like, how much have you educated yourself when it comes to real estate, and where have you invested before? Because I do believe that most of the people that say investing in real estate is too risky, we've talked about this earlier in the podcast. I would really love to know where they are on the scale of self-education. And then I think a really quick rebuttal would be is, tell me where you're investing right now. Because once they do, I can't wait to poke and ask different questions that I may assume their current risk or investment strategy is more risky.
I love that, man. Listen, I always say the antidote to fear and not taking action is education, right? Which actually leads us to the second question is, we're taught from a young age that a formal education will make you a living, but a self-education will make you a fortune. And I think this podcast is a highlight reel on that. And we've kind of covered it at length. But I mean, along with that education and that self-education, I think a lot of it, and that's a quote from Jim Rohn, by the way. But another quote from him that's so powerful is, you know, you're the average of the five people that you spend the most time with. So, you know, that also falls into the education piece. So, Logan, who have you spent more time with now that you've kind of grown? And what does that kind of quote mean to you?
Yeah, I love that quote. It is really interesting because I do think that there's a big difference between education and intelligence too, right? I think Elon Musk talks a lot about that. And I think sometimes there is this huge push to go to college or get your master's degree. And sometimes I don't even think people know why. And I actually believe that 60 to 70% of people probably shouldn't, based on what they're going for. So I do think that hands-on experience and those quotes are awesome, Tim. People that I spend the most of my time with, I actually try to spend my time with people now, business owners I spend a lot of time with. I do have a mastermind with some really high-level real estate investors across the United States that we just actually put together ourselves. So we more or less just talk about what's going on a monthly basis. For example, Jake and Gino is one of those guys that we get a chance to just chat, and a lot of operators as well too. Cause I think you mentioned it, Tim. I think there's nothing wrong with any way you can get into real estate, including syndication. But I do think it got really sexy to be able to just syndicate the deal and then hand it off to a property management company and then, like, you know, wait a couple of years and hope it got there. But there, like you said, there's a lot that's not sexy, but where you actually can make your money right now is in the repositioning operations of properties. And so we talk a lot about that. But back to your question, I try to spend my time with people that have built very successful businesses from any field. So for example, last week I sat down with a very successful, wealthy farmer who owns 4,000 to 5,000 acres of farmland, and just really, really good people. And I just want to pick their brain. You might say farming has nothing to do with real estate, Logan, so why would you do that? But again, it's about the business that he built, right? And I'd argue that providing shelter is only second to providing food. So like his business is very closely related, actually, if you think about it. And I just pull away awesome nuggets about how you build a business, how you deal with people, and especially if they're older, like what they have done or what they've learned. One of my biggest takeaways from that meeting, I'll give to your audience too, because I just thought it was awesome. He said one of the biggest things he learned, if you really want to scale, if you really want to be successful, you really want to build your business, is at any given time, not more than 50% of your time can be stuck on daily routine type items for your business. You cannot spend more than 50% of your time on things that keep your business running. Other people have to do that. You need to spend over 50% of your time on strategy, on development, on vision of where your company is going, not on daily routines. Which if you think about that, that is extremely difficult, whether you're scaling, growing, whatever. But it just like I'm trying to spend my time with people that have done it and that have built these successful businesses and they're just wealth of knowledges. So I love that question in general, because I would just say for everybody listening too, you know, if you are building your business and scaling, taking that two, three hours to have those conversations with people that are successful, more successful than you, or doing the similar things from you, can really help you think differently about what you're doing on a day-to-day basis as well.
Yeah, that's a great point. And the business owner, the farmer that you met with, makes a great point. It's about working on your business and not working in your business, right? You know, you just get lost in the minutiae. But if you're working on your business, you're going to keep growing. And that's really a big key. You know, we are in kind of a fluctuating time in the market. Interest rates are rising. And Robert Kiyosaki once said that savers are losers and debtors are winners. Could be controversial to some, but what does that mean to you?
Yeah, I've been saying this for a couple of years now. I mean, I agree. I actually think you could probably take it one step further and you could say that cash is now a liability and debt is now an asset. You know, when you have inflation at reported around 8%, but we know it's closer to 15 if you look at all the indexes and how they actually count it versus how we do. Like, you for sure can see that it's at least 15 just looking at what's going on around. But then you look at debt at, I know that's a hot topic right now too, as debt continues to increase. But I mean, I would say the same thing. Like, debt's still around 5%. It's not even close to where inflation is going. So not only do you get the benefits of leverage, especially if you do it right, but you get the benefit of debt debasement, which not enough people talk about. Like, your debt is being debased a really, really high clip, which simply means that it is easier and easier to be able to pay back your debt. So inflation, though, is a real problem. And that is one of the reasons that I continue to want to educate people, because unfortunately, all this money we continue to print, our money being debased, is not helping the poor and not helping the middle class and the hardworking class and the people that I was raised by, which is really sad, because then it grows the divide between the wealthy and the not wealthy. And the only way to combat that is financial literacy, right? It's certainly not stimulus packages. So I think it's a really important concept that you just talked about, the saving is losing. Because that's, again, what we're taught to do. And I think there's too many people that save. You can't save anymore. You just can't. You got to stack that money and save that money is to a certain point, but then you got to invest it all. Kind of like my story, right? I went broke, but that was the best thing I could have done. It wasn't sitting in the bank. It was sitting in an investment that then produced it faster and faster.
You cannot save your way to wealth. That's one of the things that got Greg and I started on our journey just a little over two years ago. So, Logan, I feel like this was a masterclass. I feel like it's only chapter one. We're going to have you back, because I could spend probably another 2 to 3 hours talking about these topics with you. But you are just about to embark on a book launch, which is incredible, because a lot of these topics that you write about and that you talk about, like here on the podcast, are really powerful and certainly resonate with Greg and I, especially, you know, what you just talked about the wealth divide. Because if you have your head down and you're just trading time for money, trying to make ends meet and not taking that extra step to get educated and then take action, you're going to be left behind. And that's just the simple truth. So I am also, Greg and I are also very passionate about this, but you just wrote a book called Find Your Financial Freedom, Let Go of Fear, Gain Control, and Achieve Lifelong Wealth. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about that and maybe how they can get their hands on a copy?
Yeah, thank you. By the way, this book took me a year and a half to be able to write. I was joking with somebody. We've been perfecting our systems for repositioning properties, and I think this book took longer than I reposition apartments sometimes. I wanted to get it right, though, guys. I wanted to get it right because there is a lot of books on financial literacy, and there's some books on financial freedom, and there's a few things I wanted to make sure this book had that those didn't. For example, I believe strongly that we should be able to explain these complex terms in very simple ways. I constantly am and surprised and irritated by the amount of people that may go to somebody, not necessarily a financial advisor, but maybe, or some people that know about money, and they talk about these things and they use big words and complex, and then the individual leaves not knowing anything more about money. Find Your Financial Literacy is about you as an individual learning your ability to be able to put your money to work, where you don't have to count on anybody else necessarily. Because even if you want a financial advisor or otherwise, or to put your money in passive income, you still have to have a level of understanding on your money to make educated decisions. This isn't something you should ever outsource, guys. If you want to outsource something, outsource your cleaning. We got to stop outsourcing your financial literacy. So I think this book takes complex terms and makes them really simple. It does have some mindset stuff, guys, like, because I do think, you know, I want to question certain societal beliefs and norms. So I question those, but we don't spend a ton of time on those, because one of my favorite books is Rich Dad, Poor Dad, for example. I think a lot of people's are, but I got done reading that book. I'm like, I don't know where the hell to start. There's nothing actionable for me to start. It's just all this mindset shit, which is great. So I wanted a book that actually had actionable steps. So in this book, in chapters 2, 3, and 4, I go through 3 really, really powerful steps that I use to be able to achieve financial freedom. Like, these steps took me from negative $40,000 into debt to a multimillionaire and financially free before I was 30. Like, these exact steps, and I'm still doing them today. They're very, very important steps. And you can also do them with your spouse or your significant other. But you can literally stop reading the book and implement these steps. I don't hold anything back. It's all in there, which I think is really powerful, because you have the mindset with the actionable steps. And there's a couple other cool things, like a chapter on legacy, because I really believe in, like, one of the best ways to learn is to teach. And my God, we should be teaching and talking about money to our kids. So there's an entire chapter dedicated to legacy and how you teach these concepts to your kids, how you do some of this stuff with your kids. I do them all with my kids now, and they're 4 and 7. So you can really teach it at a young age. And I'd be remiss if there wasn't a bonus chapter on real estate. This is not just about real estate. So if you're listening, you know, you probably do want to get into real estate. But even if you didn't, like, I do believe this book has ways to be able to get to financial freedom faster than you may have thought. But the bonus chapter is about if you want to do it the fastest way possible, which I believe you can do through real estate. So there's a little bit on that too. And then I didn't write this book to make money. I didn't write this book to make a profit. I kind of shared how I grew up, and books, literally, I can tell you, changed my life. There's not an individual that changed my life from a wealth building standpoint more than books. Unfortunately, I didn't have anybody around me. I didn't have any mentors. I didn't have any friends or family. School, nobody else did it, but books did it. Books changed my mindset single-handedly. So that is why I wrote this book. And that is why today, it just launched yesterday. And for everybody listening to this, I'm going to give it to you for 99 cents. You can look at the link in the show notes. So the ebook is 99 cents for you guys. And then the paperback and hardcover, if you're a hardcover kind of guy like me, it's basically at cost. So again, I want to be able to provide this to be able to help. At 99 cents, nobody can say they don't have the money to be able to afford a financial literacy or some sort of education. And I'm really excited to hear what you guys have to think.
Logan, that was awesome, man. Thank you so much for providing all that clarity and background on the book. I'm super excited to read it. I can't wait. It's all my favorite topics. So with that being said, Logan, how can somebody find out more about what you're doing, and where can they find you?
Yeah, my social media links, you can find me on anyone, Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram. I'm probably the most active is Logan J. Rankin. I'll send you those as well, guys, if we want to throw them in the show link. My website is loganrankin.com as well.
Awesome. Well, Logan, thank you so much. We're going to have you back at a future date. But until then, we will see you guys next week.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Passive Income Brothers podcast. We would be grateful for your support of our podcast by giving our show a 5-star rating and review, and subscribing to our show on your favorite podcast platform. Don't forget to take inspired action after listening to this show so that you can start building out your passive income streams. Finally, head on over to citysidecap.com to connect with us and find out more information about how to get started passively investing in real estate.